Okay, it's 9 o'clock. I know more people will be coming, but we should start. There's a lot to do. I think we will have two more classes on the Chatzan Sofer. Today I'll be speaking about some of his ideas that we haven't looked at yet, as well as maybe we'll get to some of his tshuvot, attitudes towards philosophy and Kabbalah. Just let me begin with two comments I didn't get to last time, as well as answer a question or elaborate on something. Just still points that I had from last semester, and I can send it if anyone is interested. I know some of you are very interested in the Chaim Grada. A letter has surfaced recently from Grada to the Chazon Ish. After the Chazon Ish had already left Europe and gone to the land of Israel, and after they had their break, and Grada is has left the Orthodox world and is part of the literati of Vilna, and he writes to the Chazon Ish that although I'm regarded as the greatest poet here in Vilna, they don't really know who I am. He talks in this letter to the Chazon Ish that that he feels that he needs to come to him, to come to B'nai Brak. So it really is incredible that even after they had this break, Grada writes to the Chazon Ish that he feel he needs him. And of course, he never went to him, and he actually refused to go to the land of Israel and the state of Israel as long as the Chazon Ish was alive. But this, it doesn't have a date, but it's clearly from around 1935 or 1936, right after the Chazon Ish went to Israel. Actually, I'll be able to date it, because it says in the letter that he hears that the Stipler has come to you. And if I'm not mistaken, that's already the end of the 30s. I forget exactly the year the Stipler went to the Chazon Ish. But that's very interesting. I call that to your attention. And the one other thing I want to call your attention, because we had so many classes on Ramosha Feinstein, a new volume of the Igros Moshe appeared over the summer. I want to call your attention to two quick responsa, which says something about the man and the era. First, Choshen Mishpat number 5, he's asked whether Jews should express opposition to the death penalty. And he writes, Chas v'shalom to us to do this, that we have to respect the laws of this country, which is a country of chesed, and it's such a wonderful country, and we have to pray for its success, and we should not teach our children that they should criticize in Yanei HaMedina things going on in the country. Just teach them Torah, and what do we need to concern ourselves with the details of government policy? I can't imagine anyone today actually having such an opinion. We assume that we're citizens, and if there's something in the country that we don't agree with, if we want to go protest down in Wall Street or anywhere else, that's our right as Americans. We're just as American as anyone else. But Ramosha Feinstein, writing this in 1969, if he was writing it in the 40s or the 50s, I maybe would have a different perspective, but you see that he feels that he's a guest. I can't imagine anyone growing up in America who would have this perception that we don't have the right, or that we should not at all get involved. I mean, look, we even have now Haredi people who run for various offices, local offices, even Congress. But I think that's interesting. Second of all, in Yoredeya number 38, if you recall the classes on Ramosha Feinstein, I spoke a bit about this term Russia, evil one, that he uses to with reference to the secularists in Israel, and I said that also shows a difference, that we would never use, people of our generation, I think, would never use the term Russia, which means an evil person, about an irreligious Jew. A Russia is one who's a child abuser, who's a murderer, but someone who's not religious, we never would use that. And it's incredible I made that point, because I really misjudged Ramosha, I think, a bit. He uses the term, but we see his real feelings in this responsum, because he's writing to this rabbi, I don't know who this rabbi is, in 1972, Yaakov Dardak. And it turns out that there was, the question is as follows. He's teaching in a day school, And there's a girl in this day school, might be a high school even, whose father is a conservative rabbi. We know that many conservative rabbis send their kids to Orthodox day schools. And the problem is that when this rabbi who writes to Ramosha had to explain about all the why we disagree with the conservative movement, the girl became very embarrassed and cried a lot. Why? Because this rabbi doesn't seem like a very smart rabbi, but he was calling all the conservative rabbis Rashaim, evil ones. So can you blame the daughter of the conservative rabbi when the teacher is saying that all these conservative rabbis are wicked and evil? So Ramosha says to him that, first of all, yes, you're going to have to deal with conservative Judaism. You have to explain why we disagree and we think it's shekerhu, that it's false, their teachings, because it is denial of certain beliefs. But then Ramosha says, which, I mean, the rabbi, if he had any sense in that at all, should have realized himself, that the girl understands that Orthodox reject conservative Judaism. She knows that there's a difference. But what she's makpid on is that you call her father a Rasha. And Ramosha says, there's no need. Ein tzorech hazkir. Because hu lo toel gamre. This is of no point to call anyone a Rasha. And then he goes on and says, no, that in today's day and age, when you use the term Rasha, people don't look at it from a Talmudic sense. He goes, from the standpoint of the Talmud, what's a Rasha? A Rasha is Misha Avar Alaveira Sheshba Malkot. If someone commits a sin in which there's lashes, so if someone's a Mechalel Shabbos, from the standpoint of strict halacha, he has the status of a Rasha. However, Ramosha says that today, the way people speak, that's not what they mean at all. What's a Rasha? A Rasha is Adam Rabba Midotav, as I said, an evil person. An Achzar, a cruel person. Like we're accustomed to, Ramosha says, it's referred to Haman HaRasha, Antiochus HaRasha. And therefore he says, when you call this girl's father a Rasha, you're saying, and even if you call the Kol HaKat, the entire, all the group of conservative Jews, Rashaim, you're calling them, you know, a terrible thing. And of course she's going to cry, and therefore you shouldn't speak this way. So I think that's interesting, first of all, what Ramosha is saying, but second of all, it clarifies this responsum that I mentioned and also has been dealt with by other people, that he refers to the leaders of Israel. This isn't his response about having an Israeli flag. He calls them Rashaim. He's not speaking about them as Rashaim in the sense that we use the term Russia today. Bill says the audio is breaking up. I don't know if anyone else feels that way. You can write for me. It could be just on your end, and especially if you're wireless. I now want to begin. And I want to clarify one thing. I had some, audio. Please make sure you don't have your audio on. No one should have the button, but it doesn't look like anyone has their audio on. So if this continues to be duplicating the spoken word, send another message. Okay, well, Shalom Eisenstadt is listening. He will try to get to the bottom of this, why audio is repeating what I'm saying. In general, we have a very good system. The last 2 weeks... so here we hear from Harvey that it's fine. So we will... so most are fine. I'll keep going. It could be if you're... in general, if you're wireless, that also creates a problem. I had a bit of a conversation with Chaim. I hear he's with me, and I want to clarify one more thing, because I think this is important, and I think this also shows the difference between how we judge the reformers of 175 years ago today versus how they were judged. And since I'm speaking about reformers, here is a picture I'm showing you right now of Aaron Chorin, the Acher. The first of the great reformers, the one that the Chasam Sofer so opposed. You see that he had the rabbinic look. No question about it. And he was a real reformer. Let me show you another picture of him. Ah, sorry. I have another picture of him. Here he is. But I think this will surprise you even more. Here's a picture of his Rebbetzin. Not a stitch of hair shown. Looks like any other traditional Rebbetzin with everything, all her hair covered. Okay, Shalom, we're getting reports of problems here. Maybe you could look into it. I will continue speaking.
I'm not having any problems here in Toronto, and if other people elsewhere are not having problems, while some are, it could very well be local problems upstream on your end of the internet. It could be other programs you're running that are taking some time, and it could be your own wireless or network. If I have no control over how it gets to your last mile, but it seems not to be a universal problem.
Okay. If Shalom is hearing it fine, then it's coming in fine for him and some others. But I will speak slowly. And if people are having problems, let us know. Bill is typing something. Here is the point I want to make, and I don't know if everyone will agree with me. But if you look at what it meant to be a Jew in Germany, say in the year 1810, the lady is the wife, the Rebbetzin of Aaron Horan, the first of the great reformers, who was regarded as Acher, the worst of all the early reformers. And you see, she looks like a Rebbetzin. Very different between then this and the next generation of Reformed Jews. But let's think of 1810. What did it mean to be a Jew? It meant that you suffered all sorts of disabilities in law. It was very difficult to attend the university. You couldn't work in civil service. There was all sorts of anti-Semitism. It would have been very easy for any of these Reformed Jews to apostatize, to become Christian. In fact, many did. From the end of the 18th century, continuing through the 19th century, many Jews said they didn't believe in Judaism. They didn't believe in Christianity either, but why not go through the motions, become a Christian? It would open up all sorts of doors. It is hard for me, at least, even though I know all about the Reformed Jews and what they were preaching, that there's no need for Shabbos and Kashrus, at the end of the day, our sources also speak about the idea of a Shem Yisrael, the importance of the name, the connection to the Jewish people. These Jews suffered for being Jewish, and they could have given it up very easily, but yet, from their own perspective, they were proud to be Jewish. They were not proud to be Jewish in the way that the traditional Jews were, but there was something about Judaism that they were willing to sacrifice economically, socially, in all sorts of ways. They refused to convert. They didn't want to go to the Orthodox shul. They wanted to go to a different type of shul. So when you look at it that way, and you see the fact that these Jews suffered, I mean, we speak about in the Holocaust that, all the Jews, most of the Jews were not religious. Probably about half weren't religious. In Poland, most were religious, but in other places they obviously weren't. We speak about any Jew who is killed because they're Jewish. We don't do any tzitzis checks or anything like that. We assume that they died al-Kiddush Hashem. And in a sort of way, I like to think of these early Reformed Jews that despite the battles they had with the Orthodox, all of them, together with the Orthodox, suffered for being Jewish. And many of the ones who suffered, their own children, wanted no part of it. But the ones who remained Jewish, at the end of the day, they suffered for being Jewish, and they gave tzedakah to Jewish charities. And in the heat of the argument, obviously the Rabbanim had to attack them. I mean, these people were preaching, you don't need Shabbos, Kashrus, or any of these things. But in retrospect, I think we can look back and see that there is positive to even the reform because they didn't take that extra step and they didn't convert. In fact, one of the Hungarian rabbis in the next generation raised a very interesting question. He says that, and I'm going to write about this one day on one of my blog posts because I think it's relevant to American society today. he raised the question, why is it that from the Orthodox you have very little apostasy, very few Jews who leave Judaism and convert, and among the non-religious, the Reform, you have many Jews who either become secular types or convert. Now, we know that there, truthfully, it's not such a great question, because there were many Orthodox Jews, children who left, but they didn't convert. But he asked the question. And he says that the reason is because for the Reform Jews, what is Judaism? It's going to synagogue a few times a year. You go to synagogue, let's say, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And if that's all you know Judaism is, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, sitting through long services with sermons and oppressing yourself, asceticism like on Yom Kippur, if you grow up thinking that's what Judaism is, well, then who wants that? So it makes sense that the children won't want anything. But if you are part of the complete Jewish calendar, and you know what Pesach is, and you know what Simchas Torah is, and you know what Purim is, then Judaism is much more. And it's like I've said facetiously many times in the past, but only half facetiously, that there's this big problem, especially in conservative Judaism, and I'm sure most of us listening to us have it with our own family, all the children intermarrying and from conservative households, and good conservative households. Conservative households which were very involved in Federation and kids who went to the Schechter schools, and yet the kids want nothing to do with it. And the truth is that maybe the best thing the conservative movement could do is tell people, don't come to shul on Yom Kippur. I think of all my family members, cousins and everything, who the one time, two times a year they go on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and they grow up, just like the Hungarian rabbi said, that this is what Judaism is, sitting through a long service that even the Orthodox have trouble sitting through, where you're fasting, and that's so out of the ordinary. Judaism is not an ascetic religion. And maybe if the conservative movement said to all these people, don't come to shul once a year on Yom Kippur, come to shul on Simchas Torah, come to shul on Shavuos, come to shul another day, then the children would grow up and see that Judaism is not just about making your twice-a-year visit to the synagogue because you feel, for nostalgic reasons, you have to. Well, you know, the grandchildren don't feel that same nostalgia, and to them, that's Judaism. The typical conservative Jew has never even heard of Shavuos. They know nothing about what it is. So, as I said, I say this only facetiously, but the truth of the matter is it maybe isn't such a bad idea. Because I wonder sometimes if all the young of the conservative are actually being turned off by being dragged to these high holiday services, which bores them out of their mind. Okay, let's now go to the Chasam Sofer. And we ended last class dealing with how he mentions that emancipation is a problem. On the one hand, we have to thank the various kings and rulers for giving us freedom. On the other hand, what this means is that now God is telling us we're going to be settled here in these countries. And he gave the parable that a king exiles his son to another country. The son is always hoping to be called back. But then when the king decides to buy his son a palace in his exiled country, then the son has to start worrying, because that means that they're going to be there for a while. This means, for the Chatzim Sofer, and he elaborates on this, that Jews in the diaspora are supposed to live a second-class existence. They're supposed to be oppressed to a certain extent, because that's what it means to live in Galut. It doesn't mean that they're supposed to be killed, obviously. It doesn't mean that they're supposed to be pogroms. What it means is that they are supposed to be second-class citizens, because that is how Jews are supposed to live in the diaspora, until it's time to be brought back to the land of Israel. This is in direct opposition to Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's position. And the Chasam Sofer goes further, saying that the more Jews try to be like non-Jews, that is, they're given all these freedoms, they're given emancipation, and the more Jews try to be like non-Jews, it increases anti-Semitism. And therefore, Jews should want to live in a ghetto, not have the same rights as everyone else, because we are different. We'll have our own based in, and we live separate existences. We don't want to be part of civil society. The equivalent would be today in America, like Satmar. They don't celebrate Thanksgiving. They don't get involved in the general pursuits. They just want to be left alone. And that's what the Chasam Sofer says. We just want to be left alone to have our own civilization. This idea that the more you want to be like the non-Jews, the more anti-Semitism is caused. This is also something which you saw perhaps in Germany as well. I think it's a European phenomenon to a certain extent, not always. It's definitely not an issue in America today. On the contrary, the Jews who try to be like non-Jews, not only does it not cause more anti-Semitism, on the contrary, that's where all the intermarriage comes from. The non-Jews want Jews who don't want to be like non-Jews. Our problem in America is not the European problem. Our problem in America is not anti-Semitism. It's the fact that the non-Jews love Jews. And many of them want to be with Jews. And assimilation is our problem. But Chasam Sofer, I was speaking in a different era. This just reminded me that the ADL... came out with their survey. You know, this is an organization which gets millions and millions of dollars in donations, and they really need to justify their existence. You know, they come out with these reports that speak about, like, in the entire country, you'll have maybe like 120 anti-Semitic episodes, the majority of them from teenagers. And, you know, and we're talking about a country of well over 200 million. But they came out with their report on trends in American anti-Semitism, and they have this, you know, 30% of Americans are anti-Semitic. I mean, and like one of the questions they asked is as follows. I mean, first of all, they should ask these questions to Jews, and then we'll see what the numbers are. But one of the questions was that Jews like to stick with their own. And if you answered yes, Jews prefer to stick with their own, then you're an anti-Semite. Well, I mean, first of all, if you ask any traditional Jew, do Jews prefer to be with other Jews, he'd say yes. So I guess that makes all of us anti-Semitic. And all you have to do is to go into any college dining room and you see the blacks sitting with the blacks and other groups. So I guess that makes all of us racist. But, I mean, can you imagine if you're a non-Jew and you live in Brooklyn or Lakewood or anywhere else, Los Angeles, anywhere where there's a significant Jewish population, and you live among Orthodox Jews and get along with them, but you know that Orthodox Jews like to associate with other Orthodox Jews, and you're asked by the ADL this question that Jews prefer to, you know, hang out with other Jews, and you answer, yes, that's true. And now the ADL is trumpeting this as that's anti-Semitism. I mean, it's unbelievable. Especially for us traditional Jews, when that is part of what we believe, even from a Hirshian perspective, is what we're obligated to do. We're obligated to, even though we were good citizens, we're obligated to prefer other traditional Jews. And since that's what we're obligated at, if a non-Jew who ever takes a class at any university about Judaism, and he's taught that Jews do not look kindly upon on intermarriage. And even conservative and reform Jews don't prefer intermarriage, and therefore, you come out of that class and you assume that, you know something? Jews prefer to marry other Jews. The ADL is branding you an anti-Semite. So, I just think that's interesting. Now, for many Jews, anti-Semitism, of course, historically gave them a reason to be Jewish. Today, no longer. The Chasam Sofer's point, however, is that non-Jew can respect us, even if he doesn't like us so much, when we stay by ourselves. However, when we try to move into his society, then we're threatening to him, and that creates more anti-Semitism. Okay, let me speak up more aspects of the Chasam Sofer's thought. Let's talk about Talmud study. Chasam Sofer is known as not just the greatest posek, the greatest halachist of his time. He's known as the greatest Talmudist of his era. Volumes of commentaries on the Talmud. And yet, he is not what we think of when we think of contemporary Talmudists. There is a tradition of Talmud study for its own sake, without any connection to practical halacha. This approach is seen in the curriculum of the Lithuanian yeshivot. which from the 19th century continuing to today shied away from practical halakha. In fact, in some examples, in some of these yeshivot, they would even focus on areas which have no practical implications at all. Kodshim and Taharot, laws of purity and of sacrifices, which today have no practical relevance. Rabbi Soloveitchik's classic article, then turned into a book, Ish Halacha, is devoted to explaining why practical halacha is not what we strive for. We strive precisely for the theoretical halacha. He compares this to a doctor versus a professor of medicine, that the doctor is one who has to leave the ivory tower and become a practitioner, and it's the same thing. A rabbi who's in a community and has to decide halacha has to leave the ivory tower, and we don't want to leave the ivory tower. We want to be in this ivory tower. The Rav says, quote, "The theoretical halacha, not the practical decision, the ideal creation, not the empirical one, represent the longing of halachic man." How much this way of thinking was revolutionary needs to be investigated, I think. As far as I know, this approach, stressing the theoretical halacha, has never been found in the Sephardic world until today. And even in the Ashkenazic world, I believe that this is a minority position, and it's really the Lithuanian perspective. In Germany, they didn't think this way. In Hungary, they didn't think this way. This doesn't mean that these scholars who rejected the Lithuanian approach had no concept of Talmud study for its own sake. They would have studied the laws of Kodshim and Taharot also. However, this type of study was viewed as secondary to the main focus of study, which was what they called Aliba Dehochata. That is, study in order to know the practical halakha. And if you looked at these yeshivot, they would study the Gemara, and then from there they move on to the Beit Yosef, the Rambam and the Beit Yosef, and they bring it into practical halakha. Contrast that to a Lithuanian yeshiva, where you will study the Rambam, but the Rambam is only as a theoretical text. You never bring it forward into practical halakha. You don't look at the Shulchan Aruch, and you don't look at the response of literature. So it's a very different type of curriculum. And the Chasam Sofer says that the main purpose of Talmud study is to know the practical halakha. He speaks about theoretical halakha, but he is clear that this is secondary. And the way he describes Talmud study was the Hungarian approach. He further disagrees with the Lithuanian philosophy. Lithuania developed the Kolo ideology. We already saw how the Chasam Sofer opposes Torah study alone in the in the land of Israel. However, even in the diaspora, he was not a fan. He says that only those who serve or are preparing to serve the community in a practical way, such as rabbanim, rabbis, dayanim, and teachers, are permitted to accept the community's monetary support for their Torah study. He states explicitly that only those who are preparing or are currently serving the community can accept community money. That is, now this doesn't mean that if the Chasam Sofer was alive today and he saw the whole system that he'd oppose it. However, in his time, he does speak against this idea that people can receive money just for studying Torah. With regard to the production of chidushim, this is a major point of Talmud study, come up with new ideas. The English term is navalei. The Chasam Sofer makes, at least what I think, a very interesting point. He says that Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, did not produce chidushim. Already you have to ask a question. If the essence of Torah study, and in the Lithuanian tradition it is indeed the essence of Torah study, is to produce chidushim, new insights. And then you tell me, as the Chasam Sofer does, that Moshe Rabbeinu, because of his position, could not produce new insights. Aren't you saying that Moshe Rabbeinu is lacking that which is the essence of Torah? And how can you deny the greatest aspect of Torah study, the chidush, to the greatest of all Torah teachers, Moshe Rabbeinu. Before I go on and answer the question, let me clarify a point about what the word chidush means. New insights. There actually is more than one way of looking at this, and I can provide sources for the both approaches. You can look at a chidush as uncovering that which is latent. That is, that which is latent in, let's say, the Rishonim or the Talmud. It's already there. It's just that it's as it were, there's an overlay. It's covered with a blanket, let's say. And we're moving the blanket back to reveal something that was there all along, but we couldn't see it. It's as if now we have better glasses. Or you can understand Chidushim, and this is Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach. You can understand Chidushim as something completely new. A new insight. Not that was latent at all. Not that the Rishonim knew this, but we're just revealing it now so we can understand it. A completely new perspective, Yesh Makom Itgader, that we have, every generation is given this ability to find new insights which no one else, perhaps not even Moshe Rabbeinu, if you recall the famous story of Rabbi Akiva, where Moshe Rabbeinu comes and sees Rabbi Akiva. But every generation has the ability to come up with new insights, not revealing that which is latent, but something completely new. I said that Rabbi Soloveitchik adopts this approach. I don't think there's any question that that's his approach. However, for full honesty, I should point out that Rav Herschel Schechter does not portray Rabbi Soloveitchik this way. Rav Schechter portrays Rabbi Soloveitchik as much more conservative, as only having the latent approach. That is, that the job of a chidush is to reveal that which is latent. And Lawrence Kaplan, probably the greatest of all the academic students of Rabbi Soloveitchik, in his review of Rav Schechter's Nefesh HaRav, takes Rav Schechter to task for making Rav Soloveitchik more conservative than he is, with a small c, and to not recognize the value of chidush for Rabbi Soloveitchik. But getting back to my question, what does the Chasam Sofer mean then when he says that Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't give chidushim? For the Chasam Sofer, there's something even greater than a chidush. For the Chasam Sofer, the chidush is revealing that which was latent. And therefore, there's something greater than that. It's better to receive the knowledge directly from God. Since Moses was able to receive this knowledge directly from God and inquire of the truth, there is no need for a chidush. There's no need for one's important, imperfect intellect. The Chasam Sofer's focus, the focus of his day, what he spent most of his time on, was Talmud and Halakha. However, that does not mean that this was his only interests. The Chasam Sofer writes as if he accepts the literal meaning of the Talmudic saying that one should divide one's time evenly between Bible, Mishnah, and Talmud, which would mean one-third of your day in Bible. Now, it's difficult to imagine the Chasam Sofer applying this, following this statement to the letter. And in one place, he's emphatic that the Halakha is more important than all three of these fields, even. However, you do see in the Chasam Sofer a stress on Bible study that's not found among his contemporaries and even his followers. What's the problem with Bible study? You don't see it so much in the Chasam Sofer's era, but you see it in the next generation very clearly. So much so that Rabbi Shlomo Kluger, I don't know how many of you have heard of Rabbi Shlomo Kluger. Rabbi Shlomo Kluger was, in the generation after the Chasam Sofer, the next generation, one of the greatest geniuses, Talmudic geniuses in the world. He wrote something like 300 books. Most of them were lost. I don't think he's part of the yeshiva world's canon today. So it's possible that in the yeshiva world, many people don't know who Rav Shlomo Kluger is. Incidentally, the very first responsum in the Igros Moshe deals with Rav Shlomo Kluger. But in his time, he was a towering figure. He is asked the following question. Is it permitted to intensively study Bible? Can you imagine? One of the greatest poskim of his time, Rav Shlomo Kluger, is asked, is it permissible to intensively study Bible? how could you even ask a question like that? We're not Catholics that like to keep the people in previous years, like to keep everyone ignorant. The Catholics even banned vernacular translations of the Bible. You have to understand the context, though. The context is that the Haskalah was rampant during Rav Shlomo Kugler's time. Rav Shlomo Kugler dies in 1865, and the Maskilim were turned off to Talmud and Halakha, and they turned their attention to Bible study and to Hebrew grammar, and they became the experts in Hebrew grammar. And they so much so that in mid-19th century Eastern Europe, no traditional Jew would speak about Hebrew grammar, because then people would assume you have a Haskalah tendencies. The assumption was that Hebrew grammar is like the Bama, the old altars, that they used to be permissible, but now that the Maskilim have adopted them, we no longer study that. And it was the same thing with Bible. If you put too much focus on Bible, Rav Shlomo Kugler actually says, his answer is, he gives that, yes, you can study Bible, but only adults. We cannot teach children Bible intensely. Why? Because that could lead them astray. If they start studying Bible intensively, they'll start investigating, and who are the leading Bible scholars of our time? It's the Maskilim, and that will lead them astray. So we do not teach children, he says, Bible intensively. Adults who are already secure in their religion, they can study Bible intensively. I think that part of the reason why Bible study, even to this day, is not taken seriously in the Haredi world is due to that. Although today we don't have Maskilim and you don't have this issue. But because Bible study became verboten, it became something that you didn't do, with few exceptions. You had some who did, but for the most part, you kept away from this. The yeshiva curriculum, therefore, centered only on Talmud study, and it's the old joke that if you want to know where a verse in the Bible is, he could tell you where it appears in the Talmud. But the truth is, to this day, Bible is not studied intensively in the Haredi world, but in the religious Zionist world. About 30 years ago, really 40 years ago, perhaps, the late Rabbi Mordechai Breuer and his followers really led a revolution. You now have intensive Bible study of all sorts. You have Machon Herzog. You have all these Bible conferences in America and in Israel. So much so that, just like in the times of the Maskilim, Tanakh study is an intensive pursuit carried out independently of Talmud study. As I've mentioned already a few times in previous classes, in the Haredi world, there's no such thing as being a Bible expert. You're a Talmud Chacham. You're a Talmudist. So you also study Torah, Tanakh. However, in the modern Orthodox, the Mizrahi, the religious Zionist world, you now have experts in Tanakh. Nechama Leibowitz, of course, was an expert in Tanakh. And you have many women who are experts in Tanakh. So I think that the Haredi hesitation goes back to the Haskalah. The Chasam Sofer, as I said, the focus is on practical halakha, but that doesn't mean that he thinks that there's no value in non-theoretical halakha. In fact, he criticizes those who write as if there's no value whatsoever in studying matters without any practical import. The way he summarizes their argument, you can see that he was well aware of the early Haskalah view on these issues. Now, I mentioned that Shlomo Kugler is an era where Haskalah is rampant. The Chasam Sofer, it's not rampant, but you have Maskilim in Pressburg, and you had Mendelssohn, you had Wesley, Natalia Hirsch Weisel. So you had these perspectives. The Chasam Sofer summarizes the Haskalah position as follows. If I'm not going to be a Dayan, why do I need to study Choshen Mishpat? Why do I need to learn the laws of sacrifices or anything like that? And this is exactly the position put forward by Weisel, Naftali Hirsch Wesley, about whom, incidentally, there's a great dispute, because many, many traditionalists and great poskim thought that Wesley was part of the canon of, quote, kosher rabbinic scholars. On the other hand, many did not. The Noda Behuda, the Chasam Sofer, they were not fans of Wesley, but many were. But Wesley did say, quote, we were not all created in order to be Talmudists. Wesley really put forth a modern Orthodox curriculum. After all, go into any of our modern Orthodox schools. Do we simply have Talmud study alone? No! All of our modern Orthodox schools recognize that not everyone's interested in being a Talmudist, so we have all sorts of classes. And when you go to the religious Zionist schools in Israel, you have different types of schools. Some have a more intensive Talmud curriculum, others study Hasidut and Tanakh. Basically, without knowing it, modern Orthodox curriculum today is really Naftali Hirsch, Hartwig, Wesley's curriculum. Our curriculum is much more in the line of the early Maskilim than it is of the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer opposes this. He quotes his teacher, Rav Pinchas Horowitz, the Hafla, who points out as far back as 1783, and this is just the beginning of the Haskalah, that none of the Maskilim had produced any works in the field of Talmud and Halakha. And the Hafla says that to criticize them. But they didn't think that was a criticism. From the standpoint of Wesley, Wesley never downgraded the value of Talmud study. He just said that it's not for everyone. I'm not going to be a Dayan. Why do I need to know this? If I have a question, I go to the Dayan. But all our children don't need to learn this. Ibn Kaspi, by the way, the medieval philosopher, said the same thing. In his ethical will to his son, he talks about how he spent his time on philosophy. And he describes how once a spoon, I forget what it was, a milk fell into a meat, or a meat spoon fell into a milk, and he didn't know what halacha was, so he had to go to the local rav, the dayan. And he quotes this story to say, though, that I'm not embarrassed by this, because the rabbi is a technician. He can tell you what halacha is. I don't need to know that. If I have a question, I go to him. I spend my time, he says, on philosophy, on the important things. So this was Wesley's, this was Ibn Ezra's position also, incidentally, and this was Wesley's position, that we train a few people to be Dayanim, but what does the average kid need to know, study Choshen Mishpat? What does he need to know this? And therefore, Wesley wrote commentaries on Avot, on biblical books, and he thought that that is more important for the young people, to have an appreciation of the Bible, of Jewish ethics, of basic Jewish laws. But, and you know, it's a real issue. Those who are involved in Jewish education know this is a big issue. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein has spoken out against these schools in Israel now, who have concluded that we don't need to take all our students and put them in a heavy Talmud curriculum where they're studying, Tosfos and Baba Metzia in detail for a whole year, and that a lot of kids can get more out of other topics. So it's a real issue in the modern Orthodox world. The Chasam Sofer's emphasis on Talmud study and study for its, you know, not just, as I said, a leave it to Hilchata, but even for its own sake, leaves that one area. And that is Ta'amei HaMitzvot. The Chasam Sofer has a good deal to say about the field of reasons of the commandments. This is a field that goes back to medieval times. I say a field. You find examples in the Talmud in which they tell you about reasons for various laws. But when I say a field, I mean where people put their mind to explaining reasons for the commandments. The Rambam and the Mor Nevuchim, you have Sefer Achinuch and others. Why? Why do they do this? Why do we need to know the reasons? The Rambam even tells us the reasons for the Chukim. It's one thing to tell us the reasons for Mishpatim, you know, for laws that are pretty obvious, so you can elaborate on why it's not proper to steal, or, you know, we can think of all these general laws. But if the Torah doesn't tell us why you have a paraduma, and the Torah doesn't tell us about kashrus and all these things, why does the Rambam feel he needs to tell us this? And this was the perspective of many medievals. The Tor famously writes that after criticizing the Rambam, we don't need reasons. God commands us, and that's all we need to do. However, the Rambam feels that it's vital to give reasons for the commandments. In fact, the Rambam says in the guide that he is able to come up with reasons for all the mitzvot except for three. And when I say reasons, if you read the Rambam, taking it as word, he's not giving you possible reasons. Like today, people might say that this is the best possible reason I can come up with, but maybe there are better reasons. The Rambam seems to be saying that this is the actual reason, that he's convinced this is the reason. That not he's giving you an option and you can come up with other reasons, but that this is the real reason. And Ibn Kaspi, who I just mentioned before, says he doesn't know what the Rambam had a problem with these other three. I forget what the other three are. One is the Shulchan in the Mishkan. I forget what the other three are, but Ibn Kaspi says, those are easy. I can give you those three. So when you get to, by the end of the day, when you finish with Ibn Kaspi, all the mitzvot all the reasons have been explained. The Rambam says there's a danger of antinomianism in not knowing the commandments, reasons. And the opponents say there's a danger of antinomianism in knowing the reasons. From the standpoint of the opponents of the Rambam, if you know the reasons for the commandments, then it might lead you not to do them. And they could point to the case of Shlomo, of Solomon, who is described, he did all these sins, he married too many wives, this is described in the Book of Kings, they turned him to idolatry, and according to the rabbis, the problem with Shlomo was that he knew the reasons. He thought he knew the reasons. The reasons you can't have so many wives is because they'll lead you astray to idolatry. So Shlomo said, well, now that I know the reason, the law doesn't apply to me because I know how to protect myself. And the upshot, the moral of the story is that even Shlomo, who knew the reasons, he wasn't able, and he was led astray. And therefore, if you know the reasons, if you know in quotation marks, that the reason for kashrus is because of health reasons. And by the way, a number of Rishonim give these reasons. If you read some of the Rishonim, the way they describe the reasons for kashrus, and I say this with all due respect to these great Rishonim, but the reasons appear to us as ridiculous, as absurd. I mean, all these reasons they give for why this bird is permissible and that isn't, for health reasons, because today we know that these health reasons are incorrect. Not only that, it's precisely because of these reasons that in later generations, people said, well, since these reasons are incorrect, we don't need to keep kosher. In other words, they didn't have enough of a perspective to know that, fine, the Rishonim were wrong on this, or the reasons spoke to that generation. In our generation, we'll give different reasons. So you see how giving reasons can lead to antinomianism. So much of the early reformers, their arguments against halacha was kashrus and against other things. They said it was to keep the Jews separate from the Gentiles because the Gentiles were pagans, they were wicked. But now that we live among Gentiles who are civilized, they worship God, there's no reason to keep these laws that were designed to keep us separate. However, the Rambam argues just the reverse. Empirically, I don't know which is more correct. But the Rambam says, by not knowing the reasons for the commandments, you will be led into antinomianism, into rejecting the law, because you look at these laws, let's say the laws of kashrus, and you'll say, what kind of nonsense is this? I can't eat this food, I can eat this food, not eat that food. Doesn't make any sense. And if you look at irreligious people today, they do make fun of the laws. They say things like, these are foolish, these are idiotic. Unfortunately, we don't have good reasons, usually, you know, because we don't know the reasons that we could explain why kashrus is, you know, we can say that it's valuable because it's a historical tradition, etc. But if some person says, this is stupid, you're telling me I can eat this food, I can't eat that food, and that's the Rambam's whole point. The Rambam said, not knowing the reasons will lead to antinomianism. And maybe it depends on the generation. Maybe in one generation, not knowing the reasons leads to rejecting, and in another generation, it's just the opposite. And the Rambam, as I said, was the leader in Tamei HaMitzvot. If those who are interested, you can, Yitzhak Heinemann, a great Israeli scholar, published a whole book on it, two volumes, and this was translated into English a couple of years ago. You can see all the back and forth. Those in our past, those figures who are more philosophical, lean towards explaining the reasons for the commandments, and the others in the other position. The Chasam Sofer, though, is opposed to reasons for the commandments. He says that all the commandments have reasons. No, there's no doubt that they have reasons, whether we know them or not, the reasons or not. Don't assume this is stated by everyone. The Rambam claims that he says that there are people who hold, he thinks this is even a position in the rabbis, that they have no reasons, that it's just God's will. And the Rambam says that when it comes to the details of the commandments, why when you have a sacrifice you have three bulls and instead of four bulls, he says there's no reason for that. The Mekubalim were very upset with this Rambam because everything has a reason for them. But the Rambam says, no, God has to pick one number. So whatever number he picks, if he says you offer one animal, you're going to say, well, why one, not two? If he says two, it comes from his will, not reason. So, and you can't say, well, there's a reason, we just don't know it, because the Rambam says there is no reason. It comes from God's will. Because if there is a reason, then we could know it. We might not know it, but in theory we could. The Chasam Sofer says that we do not want to know the reasons, even though there are reasons. And he says the essence of a mitzvah is to perform it without the reason. To do otherwise is to taint the value of the mitzvah. We do mitzvot because God commanded us. It's almost like Yishaya Leibovitz. We do that because God commanded us. There are reasons, but we don't want to know the reasons because, as I said, that taints the value of the mitzvah. It becomes almost self-worship. We're doing the mitzvah then because of the value it gives to us. But on the contrary, that's not why we do mitzvot. We do mitzvot because God commanded them. In terms of the chukim, he's not referring to mishpatim, which the reason's obvious, but for chukim, where the reason's not apparent, and in which there is a long tradition of providing reasons, the Chasam Sofer says, furthermore, if you try to provide reasons for what God has characterized as a chok, it is intellectually arrogant. God hasn't given us the reason. You, therefore, are going to try to come up with a reason? If the reason was so obvious, then God would have given it to us. The fact that he didn't shows that it's not something we should be looking into, and it's beyond our ken. He says that that's the significance of a chok, that it's beyond our intellect. That's precisely the significance. And as I said, this is the Torah says the exact same thing. The Chasam Sofer's position on natural law is also relevant, therefore, in this regard. Because you have the old dispute. It's actually called the Euthyphro problem, because it's discussed, the Euthyphro, Plato's work, in which, he quotes Socrates as saying, here's the question, why is the bad good? This is how Socrates is quoted. Why do the gods oppose a certain action? Why do they oppose murder? Do they oppose murder because murder is wrong, and that's why they oppose it? Or is it wrong because the gods oppose it? What's the basis of this, of the opposition? You have the same argument in Jewish sources. I think I have some things here. Avi Sagi has written about this. So do I have it here? Hold on a second. No, I don't have it here. I think the dominant position among Jewish thinkers is the idea that there is some sort of natural law, that it's not that murder is wrong because God says it's wrong, but rather murder is wrong, sort of stealing is wrong, and because it's wrong, therefore it's commanded. Although the other position, what has been termed divine command morality, the idea that it's wrong because God commands it, and that's the reason why, that's the basis, that helps explain problematic passages in the Bible. That helps explain the Akedas Yitzchak. That helps explain the extermination of the Canaanites in the land of Israel. if you assume that murder is wrong because God says it's wrong, not that God says it's wrong because it is wrong, then you don't have such a question. Normally, we don't kill because God says, but if God says in this case you do kill, then it's okay because the source of morality is in God. So you could, that helps you, but there's so many passages in the Bible, all throughout the rabbinic literature, which seem to argue in a different direction. Just think of Abraham. How, if you adopt this divine command morality perspective, how do you make sense of what Abraham says to God when he's going to, shall not the judge of the earth do righteously? I mean, if there is no concept of righteousness, of natural law, separate from God, what type of question is this? What do you mean? You're comparing God's action. Abraham is saying that, there is a right, and that we expect God to be in line with that because God is truth. And therefore he should be. So there's so many passages in the Talmud also. However, the Chasam Sofer declares that why do we refrain from murder, adultery, and all these things? Not because it's inherently destructive, but because of God's command. He goes further. He says, if you abstain, let's say, from murder, for any other reason, you're worshiping other gods. Because even mitzvot sichliot, mitzvot which have reasons, we perform them because of God's command. This isn't divine command morality. He's not saying that the only reason it's wrong to murder is because God says it's wrong. He doesn't go that far. But he's saying the reason we refrain from it is because God commanded it. That's the essence of it. That's how, when we think about these things, that's what our focus needs to be, that because God commanded us, that's why we don't do it. The Rambam has a different perspective. I mean, the Rambam sees this as this position of Chasam Sofer is very wrong-headed. The Rambam deals in his commentary, the introduction to Avot, the 8 chapters, with two apparently contradictory trends in rabbinic thought. On the one hand, you have passages that say that we really should want to sin, but we don't sin because God commanded us. So, for example, there's a passage that says we don't say that we don't like non-kosher food. No, we like non-kosher food. It would taste very good, but we don't because God commanded us not to. So we have this idea, on the one hand, that we would want to do these things, but God commanded us not to, and therefore we acknowledge that these things are good and fine, and pork is probably a wonderful dish, but we have a special yoke of the law which God has given to us, and we are loyal to that, and therefore we abstain to fulfill the divine word. On the other hand, the Rambam says, what's going on here? Can you imagine anyone saying, I really want to rape this woman, or I really want to steal or kill this person, but I'm not going to do it because God commanded me? Therefore, the Rambam says we need to distinguish. When it comes to the ritual commandments, the healthy position is precisely to want to. You smell that food and it tastes good, you want it. But you know that we can't because God commanded us. And that's the healthy approach. To simply say, I don't want to do it, I don't like this non-kosher food, then you're not acknowledging the point that you're supposed to abstain because of God's divine command, not because of personal inclination. On the other hand, in these laws between man and man, if your attitude is, I really want to kill this person, but I'm going to refrain because God commanded us, you're a barbarian. You are not supposed to have that inclination. And that is what you're supposed to abstain from these things precisely because they are wrong. Now, I see it's already 10 o'clock. I want to continue a little more next class about the Chasam Sofer and his approach to natural law and philosophy and then Kabbalah. Chasam Sofer really is a good example of a trend in how to approach Kabbalah. On the one hand, his denial that he has involvement with it. On the other hand, clear evidence that he was involved in it. Then we'll move on to his opposition to Chassidut and what Chassidut tried to do with Kabbalah. And I'll conclude, I don't know if it's going to be next class, it'll probably be the class after, with some important and interesting responsa, including responsa that to this day affect our Jewish community. And just to give you one, we'll speak about Mitzitza Bepeh, and a few others. So we still have a good deal more we need to do on the Chasam Sofer. Shlomo asks a good question. What about homosexuality? Rabbi Rappaport, Chaim Rappaport, in his book, deals with this. It would appear from most sources that homosexuality falls into the category that you should not have such an inclination. I mean, you should, for example, a man should have an inclination for a woman, not to rape her, but a sexual desire. And if he doesn't, look in the Svarim blog post I just quoted. It says, Rabbi Gifter quotes a Rishon that you're a chamor, that is, you're not human. And I'll say about women too. God created us. Thank God that we have sexual drives. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any humanity. So you're supposed to have these drives. However, notice that homosexuality is part of the seven Noahide laws. So based upon that, many people assume that these are basic and that there is no such inclination. Rav Moshe Feinstein states this explicitly, that no one even has an inclination, which we know is wrong, but you see how far he goes in that direction. On the other hand, if you look in Rabbi Rappaport, you will see that there are sources that say no, that homosexuality should be viewed as no different than heterosexual inclinations, and that although the average person perhaps doesn't have this inclination, having the inclination itself is in no way to be compared to having an inclination for, let's say, to steal or anything like that. It's nothing to be ashamed of. That's just who you are. Now, granted that that is an approach which people today, like Shmuley Boteach and Rabbi Rappaport, will find more appealing today. Rav Cook, for example, in dealing with homosexuality, says that Jews don't have these inclinations. I mean, it sounds almost like the president of Iran saying that there's no homosexuals in Iran. However, even for people like Rabbi Rappaport, who want to put homosexuality into the same category as any other sin, that there's nothing wrong with having an inclination, you do find earlier sources that can be brought to bear on this. Yeah, well, it depends how do you view homosexuality. I mean, take incest, for example. If you view homosexuality like incest, no one's going to say that it's natural to have feelings of incest, and that yet I want to have sexual relations with a close family member, but I just control myself because the Torah says not to. That's precisely what the Rambam's speaking about. That is not healthy. If you have these inclinations, it doesn't make you a bad person. It just means you don't have a normal outlook and you have to work hard. But it's not something that you want to have, and that's what the Rambam is referring to. Incest definitely falls into the category of where it's better not to have any of these inclinations. So what about homosexuality? Where you place it? That's, so I would recommend, if you're interested, Rabbi Rappaport's book is full of insight into this. And Rabbi Rappaport is himself of the position that you should view homosexuality in line with other ritualistic type of or sexual, heterosexual type of feelings, that just view this as something for those people who have this inclination, for them it's natural and they just have to overcome it. Rabbi Rappaport, I did not realize this because it's not an Igros Moshe. I know the Igros Moshe very well, having gone through so much of it carefully, but in the Dibros Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein, this is his Talmudic commentary. I mean, Rav Moshe Feinstein, who says this, has this crazy idea that gays are just doing it to rebel against God, that no one really has a homosexual inclination. No one today, even the most Haredi, would say something like that. But it's a reflection of a different era. But in the Dibros Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein says that there is no Torah prohibition, or rabbinic prohibition for that matter, for lesbianism, for non-Jews. There is a Noahide commandment for non-Jews, male homosexuality, but no prohibition at all for female homosexuality. So based upon that, you would have to assume that for a female, Jewish or non-Jewish, having homosexual inclinations should not be viewed as at all, you know, out of the ordinary population-wise, but not out of the ordinary in terms of what we are speaking about, because proof is that there's not, from a Moshe Feinstein's perspective, there's nothing wrong for a non-Jewish woman to do it. A Jewish woman can't do it simply because that's it's the commandment. But you know, if you're going to say that that there's nothing unnatural in a halachic sense for a non-Jewish woman to do it, then I guess we have to explore the implications of that for Jewish women. As I said, that's in the Dibur of Moshe, and I was shocked when I saw that because I never heard that, and I checked it out, and it's there. Shlomo says the Rishash, that's Rav Strashun, Shmuel Strashun of Vilna, says in the time of the Gemara, the Baalei Gemara didn't know Chumash. That is correct, he says that. That's because you don't have to go to the Rishash. Tosfos says it about some of them. We have passages in the Talmud where we see that they misquote or they didn't know Tanakh. And already Tosfos says that not everyone was a bucky in Tanakh in those days. All the Acharonim have a problem with this. And they, some of them reject Tosfos. The Chidah really goes to town on this. The Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai, because how can you say this about... But that's what Tosfos says, that people focused on different areas. And look, today, plenty of great Talmudic scholars are not experts in Tanakh either. I mean, in the days of the Talmud, some people focus on Tanakh. Some people focus on Agadah, others focus on Halakha. There are plenty of examples, including the Chasam Sofer, who misquotes a biblical verse because they're quoting it from memory. I have known great Talmudic scholars, people who even are Gedolei Yisrael. I do not think that if you would ask them that they would remember verses in the book of Daniel, or verses in the book of Eov, Job, or some other things. Tanakh is not something that our Talmudists study, so in the days of the Gemara, perhaps not either. Yes, and you are correct. And in my book on the Rambam has many misquotes. Who's greater than the Rambam? And the Rambam makes mistakes, and the Rambam was an expert in Tanakh. But, you know, it could be also, when Tosfos says they weren't experts in Tanakh, he means they weren't experts in the sense, no one says this as far as I know, but this is my own approach. It means they weren't experts in the sense that they could start, you know, just like today, a Talmud Chacham usually could pretty much quote all Psukim in the Torah because he does Shnayim Mikra. How often do people, especially if it's not part of a Haftorah, how often do Talmud Chachamim look at books of Nach? So when they say they're not experts in the Bible, even if they're referring to Torah, it means that if you give them a few words, they can't just continue the Pasuk on their own. You know, they don't know it backwards and forwards. You know, you could be a great Talmudic scholar. You could be a great posek. It doesn't mean you memorize, you know, all the psukim in the Torah. So when it says they're not experts, that's what I'm inclined to think. It doesn't mean they don't know. It just means that, you know, they don't know it by heart. They can't quote the entire Torah word for word. Okay, well, everyone, thank you very much. I will not be here next Monday night. I'm giving a lecture. Monday night was the only night I could do it in New York City. But we will pick up, God willing, in 2 weeks. And as I always say this time of year, for those who celebrate Thanksgiving, have a happy Thanksgiving. It is in New York. It's at the Drisha Institute. It's on censorship. Supposedly, there should be an ad in the Jewish Week this week. It's in Manhattan. I've never been to the Drisha Institute, but I'm looking forward to being there. Hope we get a nice turnout. Okay, good night, everyone. Thanks again.